You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Dr. Pry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Pry, I want to talk about electromagnetic pulse in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, I want to read your biography, if I may.
Certainly. Thank you.
Now, I want to warn the listeners, it's a little long, but I think it's important. Dr. Pry, as I mentioned before, you're the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, which we're going to talk about in a moment. You have served on the Commission on the Strategic Posture of the United States established by the U.S. Congress 08-09. You were the director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum, an advisory body to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction. That was 05-09. You're on the Commission to assess the threat to the United States from electromagnetic pulse. EMP attack. From now on, when I talk about electromagnetic pulse, I'll say EMP. It's a lot easier. Also commonly known as the EMP Commission, established by the U.S. Congress 01-08 as professional staff on the House Armed Services Committee of the U.S. Congress with portfolios in nuclear strategy, WMD, Russia, China, NATO, the Middle East, intelligence and terrorism 95-01 as an intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy and operational plans. That was 85-95. Where you were formally recognized by the agency for your expertise, groundbreaking research, and outstanding accomplishments, and as a verification analyst at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, responsible for assessing Soviet compliance with nuclear and strategic forces arms control treaties 84-85. I know that's a mouthful, but I want the listeners to know who we're dealing with here. So thank you for letting me get that out.
Well, thank you. Another Washington bureaucrat.
You're not that. I know that from speaking to you over the past couple of years. But now, for the benefit of the listeners, let them know, what is the Task Force on National and Homeland Security? When it started, what it is?
Well, this is a newly established task force that was established by Congress. It's a congressional advisory board, and it serves the Congressional EMP Caucus. And its job is to help provide technical and operational policy advice and legislative help to the Congress to get the nation protected against natural and man-made EMP effects. But it also is a unique task force in that because EMP affects everything, it has an extremely broad area of responsibility. It basically has a responsibility for everything. It's the only institution in the Congress or in the federal government that covers both the areas of responsibility for the Department of Defense, which is foreign threats, and the Department of Homeland Security, which is domestic threats. So in addition to EMP, we deal with such matters as how do you protect the critical infrastructures, the electric power grid, communications, transportation, banking and finance, food and water. What about terrorist cells within the United States that could coordinate with an EMP attack and be part of an information warfare operation? Because the bad guys aren't likely to do just EMP. They're going to do things like sabotage, cyber attacks, throw in the whole kitchen sink. Part of protecting against EMP is protecting against the whole threat. So we cover those things, missile defense, nuclear deterrence. And in our charter, it says any other issues of relevance. So basically, everything is what the task force at the end of the day is responsible for.
What exactly is EMP?
Electromagnetic pulse is a super energetic radio wave, basically, that can be caused by a nuclear explosion detonating at high altitude, and the pulse will propagate from the point of the detonation through line of sight to the horizon, so it can cover vast geographic areas. For example, a nuclear weapon detonated at an altitude of about 200 kilometers can cover the entire contiguous United States with a pulse that would fry electronics everywhere, in the air, in airplanes, or on the surface, power lines, personal computers sitting on your desk, even things underground. An electromagnetic pulse can also be generated by Mother Nature. A solar flare, coronal mass ejection more technically, coming off the sun can cause a natural EMP that can have an effect similar to that of a high-yield nuclear weapon detonated over the United States. And although this kind of phenomena by nature is rare, the commission on which I served, and this has been verified by the National Academy of Sciences and several subsequent commissions, estimated that phenomena like this, called a great geomagnetic storm, like the Carrington event that happened in 1859, occurs about once a century or so. And we're actually overdue for another Carrington-type event. Now, when the Carrington event happened in 1859, it didn't matter because that was the horse and buggy days. We were just starting to introduce electrical infrastructures and things like telegraph systems, which burst into flame, by the way, in 1859. It caused forest fires. They didn't know what was happening, but that's what it was. It was an electromagnetic pulse from the sun that caused that early electrical infrastructure to collapse. If that were to happen today, given that our survival now depends, everything depends directly or independently on electricity, were a Carrington event to happen today, given our current state of unpreparedness, it's estimated we would lose about 2/3 of the national population, 200 million Americans dead from starvation, disease, and societal collapse.
Wow.
That, by the way, is also why Iran wants the bomb. because they only need one bomb. Any bomb can basically do this against the unhardened civilian critical infrastructures, and they openly write about that, and we have seen them practice launching their missiles fused to altitude, which is a clear signature of preparing to do an EMP attack. All they lack is the bomb.
Now, you know, you hear a lot about Iran and that they want to get the bomb. A lot of people say, well, wait a second, Iran really has never attacked any other country, so why would they do that now?
Well, actually, they are attacking us even as we speak. Iran is the world's leading sponsor of international terrorism, and we know that they are funneling arms and explosive devices to terrorist groups both in Iraq and Afghanistan for the purpose of killing American soldiers. Moreover, members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard have actually gone across the border and killed American soldiers in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, neither the Bush or Obama administrations like to talk about that very much because they have not wanted to widen the war, but Iran has actually been at war with the United States. Furthermore, although people deny it, if you carefully read the 9/11 Commission report. I don't remember the page number off the top of my head, unfortunately, but the 9/11 Commission report points out that Iran did play a role in the 9/11 attacks on the United States, that Iran did end up supporting the 9/11 terrorists, which was the bloodiest attack on American soil that ever happened. So Iran has already attacked us, and they openly write in their military doctrine about attacking the United States to remove us as an actor from the world stage, both for geopolitical reasons, because they consider themselves at war with us now, and they would eliminate the greatest threat to their existence, which is the United States. But also for ideological reasons. The mullahs, who are the ones who really run Iran, they are what are called twelvers. They subscribe to this ideology that the Mahdi, that is the 12th Imam, that we are in the end times. And in their eschatology, when the 12th Imam returns, there are signs of this. And you can actually facilitate the return of the 12th Imam by reestablishing the Islamic caliphate over the Middle East, over the entire world, actually.
Right.
And by eliminating the infidel powers. And so they're moved by more than just normal geopolitical. In fact, the normal geopolitical calculations may not even figure in some of the actions they're taking. This eschatological, ideological motive may be the main thing driving them.
Mm-hmm.
Those are reasons why. So they have attacked us. It's not true they haven't. They've actually attacked us very much. It just hasn't been a case of an openly declared war yet. And they openly write about getting nuclear weapons to basically eliminate us, the great Satan, as an actor on a world stage.
Great. Well, let's hope that that's not true, because I'm kind of having fun lately. Now, this Harrington event, which you brought up earlier, I'm glad you did, because I was going to ask you. That's the solar storm of 1859, also known as the 1859 solar superstorm, or the Harrington event, because it was observed and recorded by this fella, Richard D. Harrington. You said that at that time, we didn't have telephones or television or really much of anything like we have today, but we did have the telegraph. And you were saying that the solar storm actually caused these telegraph units to explode?
Yes, that's right. And a lot of the telegraph stations, they exploded or they burst into flame and caused the telegraph stations to actually catch on fire worldwide. And the telegraph lines, and they were very robust lines, by the way. I mean, they were thick cables that they used back in those days, actually would burst into flames in many places and cause forest fires, large forest fires. And even the transatlantic cable that had just been laid by the Great Eastern in 1859, they didn't know it at the time, but the pulse was so powerful it reached down through the depths of the Atlantic Ocean and burned out that cable. And the cable had to be relayed.
From August 28th, 1859 till September 2nd, numerous sunspots and solar flares were observed on the sun. Just before noon on September 1st, the British astronomer Richard Harrington observed the largest flare, which caused a massive coronal mass ejection, CME, to travel directly toward Earth, taking 17 hours. This is remarkable because such a journey normally takes 3 to 4 days. Is a coronal mass ejection the same thing as a sunspot or a solar flare?
No, it isn't. That's why I referred to it technically that way. There is a technical difference between a solar flare among scientists. When laymen are speaking about it, a solar flare usually refers to anything that comes off the sun. That can include coronal mass ejections or X-rays that come off. There's a lot of things that are put out by the sun. But when you start getting into the science of the sun, they start making these distinctions. And there are legitimate actual distinctions between them. But the thing that can actually cause a great geomagnetic storm, the correct scientific term is the CME, or coronal mass ejection. But it's not incorrect as a layman to refer to it as solar flares, because that tends to encompass the whole range of phenomenology that's flaring off the sun.
Okay, great. Well, I wanted to be clear on that. Now I know. Thank you. You told me in an email just recently, and of course we talked about this during our last interview about a year or so ago, where you said that the solar maximum commences in December 2012, just 6 months from now.
That's correct.
Right. Can you explain to the listeners what is the solar maximum and why is it supposed to commence in December 2012?
Well, the solar maximum occurs every 11 years, and we don't have a precise understanding of why that is. It has to do with the dynamics. The sun is not a static thing. If you look at the surface, it looks like a boiling pot. If you look at a pot of boiling water on your stove, you might notice that as it heats up and boils, that there's a regularity to it in terms of the way the water flows around that particular pot, because
right.
the way the pot shape, because the way the flame is positioned underneath, and the sun is exactly the same way. And so there are sort of cycles that happen. As it boils with these thermonuclear bubbles that are going on inside because of these thermonuclear reactions that make the sun
right.
and put out these enormous amounts of energy. And every 11 years or so, the sun reaches a point where it puts out a large number of coronal mass ejections and solar flares and other things. Just like if you were watching that pot of boiling water, there might be a pattern to it where in the circulation of the water, it bubbles more furiously at some times. And other times it might actually go quiescent. And that's the way it is with the sun. For about a decade, it tends to go quiescent where it'll put out solar flares and coronal mass ejections periodically, but then you get a real surge every 11 years. Again, we don't understand the sun well enough to know exactly why that is, but we do know it has to do with the dynamics of the thermonuclear reactions within the sun, how that particular big stellar pot boils, and it lasts a year, the solar maximum, and then it'll go quiescent again. Now, a Carrington event can happen at any time. It doesn't have to be during a solar maximum. In fact, the Carrington event itself didn't happen during the solar maximum, so that's worrisome. It's sort of a roulette game. CMEs are coming off the sun all the time. Will the Earth be in the path and get hit by one of these particularly powerful CMEs? So it's like a big roulette game. And it just stands to reason that when you have more CMEs coming off, you've got a better chance of getting hit by one and having a Carrington event happen.
Right.
And there is a scientific consensus, not that a Carrington event will truly happen during this next 11-year solar cycle, but there is heightened concern everywhere, including even in the Obama White House. President Obama's science advisor actually publicly warned about this last year in an article called Celestial Storm Warnings about the possibility of a catastrophic solar storm coming up in 2012-2013. So even the White House, which tends not to take a lot of threat seriously, is concerned about this. It doesn't take a genius to do the arithmetic that we get these big geomagnetic storms, a great geomagnetic storm, about every century. The last one was 1859. Well, we're about 50 years overdue for one, aren't we? And now we've got the solar maximum coming up. All these numbers look pretty scary. So we're really concerned about trying to get the country protected as quickly as possible. Hopefully, we'll continue to be lucky and we won't get hit during the solar maximum. But it would be not responsible of us, shall we say, from a public policy perspective, to base security and survival of not only in our country but the entire world, to base that on the hope that we won't have a recurrence of Carrington, especially since we're overdue for another such event.
Right. Now, Carrington was 1859. Is there anything recorded in the history book about a prior Carrington event that happened in the 1700s?
You can go back and find evidence of earlier Carrington. They're not really so much in history books because this is very new. The idea of a great geomagnetic storm really originated in 2008 with the EMP Commission reporting on the phenomenology, and that caused people to go back and do more of the historical research and stuff. I was actually in the room when Dr. Graham, who had been President Reagan's science advisor, was pacing back in front of a blackboard, and the thought occurred to him about the possibility of a great geomagnetic storm or something that he likened to a space hurricane, because he noted that we get normal geomagnetic storms that happen every year, but they don't affect the United States because they're small, relatively speaking, and they only affect countries at high northern latitudes like Canada. Canada got hit by a geomagnetic storm, a normal kind of geomagnetic storm in 1989 that knocked their Hydro-Quebec grid out and almost caused the evacuation of Toronto and caused billions of dollars of damage. Now, it wasn't a world-ending event because it was just a normal geomagnetic storm. But if you got a Carrington, not only would that affect the United States, it would affect the entire world. It would collapse electric grids and critical infrastructures everywhere. And there are things in between Carrington and normal geomagnetic storms that we also have to worry about. There was a storm in 1921 called the Railroad Storm. Now, we are so used to electricity. We're not used to thinking of the United States in the 20th century as being a not electrified society.
Right.
But fortunately, in 1921, it wasn't really until the Roosevelt administration that the country really started getting electrified. We were still largely a non-electrified society. So fortunately, the railroad storm didn't have catastrophic consequences either. But if it were to happen today, the National Academy of Sciences estimates that it would knock out the electric grid and other critical infrastructures for a period of 4 to 10 years. 4 to 10 years. Some argue that if the grid is knocked out for a year, and you lose two-thirds of your national population, you're never getting the grid back. So that could be read as an optimistic scenario, that you could even reestablish the grid after being without power for 4 to 10 years, and those things happen more frequently. But if you go back in older historical times, the signs of a great geomagnetic storm, people would be ignorant of the phenomenology. They don't know it's being caused by the sun, but the signs are unmistakable. The aurora borealis shows up on the equator in 1859 in the Carrington event. It was so bright that you could read newspapers by night at London. That's so recognizable that people will record it in their diary, or it'll get reported in a newspaper. And so you can go back and look for those unmistakable signs and say, oh, here's another one.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. We know that scientifically, mathematically, this is a possibility.
It's not just a possibility. It's a certainty and an inevitability. A Carrington event will happen. It's just a question of when.
What is Congress doing to protect the grid here in the United States?
Well, I'm sorry to report that right now we're not doing anything.
Since the last time we spoke, which was about a year and a half ago, they have not done anything since that time. Has anything changed?
Congress is trying. There's a bill called the SHIELD Act that, when you and I talked last time, I believe had been introduced, was there in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee,
right,
which is led by Chairman Upton. But the bill hasn't moved. We were closer back in 2009, 2010. There's bipartisan consensus on this, by the way. This isn't a Republican or Democrat thing. The Democrats are equally concerned about this. They introduced a bill before the Republican Congress called the GRID Act, and this was sponsored by two of the most liberal members of Congress, Mr. Waxman and Mr. Markey. Waxman was the chairman of that committee at the time. And it passed the House unanimously. Everybody voted for it. The most conservative Republicans and most liberal Democrats all got 100% behind it and sent it on to the Senate, and they did it very early. Then, unfortunately, one senator prevented the bill from coming to the floor for a vote, so it didn't pass. Then the Republicans took over the House, and to their credit, Mr. Franks introduced the SHIELD Act, which is very similar, virtually identical to the GRID Act. It tries to accomplish the same thing. And, unfortunately, it's been stalled there for 18 months, and Mr. Franks has been fighting hard to try to get it through. I've certainly been, a lot of people have been pulling for it to make it go through. But we do have a David and Goliath scenario here because the electric power industry doesn't want it. They have a huge and powerful lobby. And the job of lobbyists, even though there are a lot of people in the electric power industry that understand the threat and want to do something about this, unfortunately, the smart engineers who work for the electric power industry are not in Washington as lobbyists. The electric power industry hires lawyers whose cyclopic job it is to oppose any bill that comes down the pike that Congress would pass that empowers any part of the federal government to make them do something, to anything, or that might make them spend money on anything. That's their single job, and they're very effective at doing it, and they have much deeper pockets than I do or other people that want to get these bills passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been lobbying against the bill, and that's basically what's been holding it up.
Okay, so those are the bad guys then.
Yes. Now, we've been working on them, and they've been saying the right things and moving toward this. Maybe their behavior will change, but I doubt it. Like any big industry, they tend to do what their lawyers want them to do, not what their engineers want them to do. At least when it's in Washington, that is the case.
Even when the U.S. national security is at stake?
Even when U.S. national security is at stake, and even when the lives of people are at stake.
Right.
I'm a small government conservative myself. I don't believe in increasing government or federal power any more than is necessary to provide for the public safety. But there is a role, a legitimate role for government when it comes to public safety and national security. That's why we have government. And we know from experience that industry's job is to be as efficient as possible and to make things as inexpensive as possible. That's their job. They're supposed to obey the invisible hand of Adam Smith. And the invisible hand of Adam Smith doesn't want to spend money on national security because that's the job of government. And so that doesn't enter into their calculations. And we know historically that with industry, they basically have to be forced to do the right thing when it comes to public safety. And arguing with the electric power industry today is much like arguing with the Zeppelin industry in the 1920s, who in the 20s would have assured you before the Hindenburg that traveling by hydrogen power is the most efficient, safest thing in the world and nothing will ever go wrong.
Right.
And, of course, the automobile industry never wanted to put in seat belts. The motorcycle industry resisted helmet laws. You go back to the progressive era, we had to pass and establish a Pure Food and Drug Administration so that you wouldn't have thumbs showing up in your peaches. And these are the kinds of things that government does have a necessary role, and this is one of them. Right now, the electric power industry operates in a 19th century regulatory environment. Let me use another metaphor.
Okay.
I consider myself a Tea Party conservative, okay? But I support the existence of the Federal Aviation Administration. I don't want to trust the airline industry to look after the public safety. We need oversight where that's concerned. And the FAA, if they get reports that there are metal stresses showing up in the wings of some aircraft, they're going to make those aircraft be grounded because they don't want to risk hundreds of lives on an unsafe aircraft. When an aircraft crashes, it isn't just up to industry to investigate what happened. We don't have to trust industry. We have this FAA so that we know there's an objective outsider who's going to make sure that whatever caused that crash is never going to happen again, and we're going to investigate it thoroughly and make sure that it doesn't happen again. Do the best we can. We don't have any equivalent of the FAA for the electric power industry. The industry literally is operating in a 19th century environment. That's one of the purposes of the SHIELD Act. The government just doesn't have the power to make industry do the right thing, and industry can't be expected to do that on its own. They're not responsible for national security. There's got to be methods of compensating them to do this. They've got to have a level playing field because they do compete with each other. And imagine you do have numerous electric utilities in the country. You can't leave it up to 100 different utilities to say, well, we're all going to do this simultaneously so that nobody gains a competitive advantage. That has never worked in the past. It won't work now. That's why you need something like the Federal Energy Regulatory Military Commission. We do have a FERC, but it doesn't have the authority to level the playing field and say, thou shalt go forward and protect the electric grid from EMP, and you can pass the cost on. We're going to compensate you so that it doesn't break the bank, so that this is affordable and reasonable. And that's why we need the SHIELD Act. That has to happen before we can make any progress. That's what's been holding us up.
I'm glad you explained it that way, because now it makes complete sense. If their regulatory scheme is back in the 19th century, then yeah, of course it's going to be a battle. Thank you for explaining that. Now, the U.S. isn't doing anything, and now I know why. You were in England. You had addressed members of Parliament and the House of Lords at Westminster Palace in May on EMP threat. What happened there?
Yeah, that's right. There was an international EMP summit called the Electric Infrastructure Security Summit that was convened, and 20 nations attended. The United Kingdom, Britain, takes the threat very seriously, too, as do an increasing number of nations. And Parliament hosted this international summit and invited me to speak, and invited our EMP caucus to speak as well. The Home Secretary spoke at the summit. The British Home Secretary is the equivalent of our Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, plus the head of the FBI and domestic law enforcement agencies. Home Secretary is responsible for domestic security.
Right.
And he spoke at the summit and said, this is a serious threat. It's going to cost money, but we're going to do it because we can't afford to have our electric grid vulnerable. That happened in May. And basically, that officially puts the British ahead of us in terms of taking steps to protect their electric grid. Their system is a little different, organized differently than ours. They do have administrative authority over their electric power industry and can basically ensure that they do the right thing. And so basically what had happened the year before that was that the defense committees in Parliament had done a study. They had looked at this and said, are the Americans right? Is this a threat that we need to be concerned about? And they came back and said, yes, this is a serious threat. We need to do something about it. It doesn't cost that much to fix it. Let's go forward. And basically what happened in May is that the government officially agreed with its committee and made a decision that they are going to go forward. So we're still arguing over here. 4 years after the EMP Commission delivered its report and made its recommendations, basically provide a plan. Almost half a decade later, we're still arguing. By the way, the EMP Commission plan, it would have taken 3 to 5 years to protect the electric grid and other critical infrastructures, all the critical infrastructures, in 3 to 5 years. And had we started in 2009 on implementation of the EMP Commission plan, we might already be protected before the commencement of the solar maximum and before Iran gets the bomb. Unfortunately, that's not the situation. We've been stuck on the Hill. Congress has been doing the right thing, but we haven't been able to move that critical bill. It isn't a technological problem. It isn't a money problem. It's an institutional and legal problem. And basically, the lawyers are killing us.
Right. And that's the SHIELD Act, right?
Yes, SHIELD Act, H.R. 668.
And that's an acronym for the Secure High Voltage Infrastructure for Electricity from Lethal Damage Act. We're not going to be going much longer. I know we're going a little more than I said, but please.
Oh, please. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I don't often get a chance to get a platform, and I'm grateful that
that's
you're giving me one.
That's pretty amazing, because, and I remember, and I mentioned this earlier before the interview, I remember on our first interview, you were shocked because I was the first journalist to contact you over that story that broke about North Korea trying to get a super EMP. It was amazing to me, and it's still amazing to me, that the mainstream media, they move in lockstep, but you would think that somebody would say, hey, wait a second. I mean, this guy kind of knows what he's talking about. Let's do what he has to say, but nobody's talking to you, right?
That's right. Unfortunately, I don't get many calls like that. I do get some calls on other things. Actually, after this interview this afternoon, I've got an interview with National Geographic, but not on EMP. They're interested in my book, War Gear. I wrote a book years ago about a number of nuclear close calls we had with the Soviet Union and then Russia,
right.
And they're interested. They're doing a documentary on the 1983 war scare. I wish there was as much interest in the threat we face now that threatens to kill us now, and is actually scarier than the 1983 war scare, than this historical kind of interest.
I can't figure it out, but you have put together a white paper, basically a manuscript, 192-page document on EMP, and in the dedication, you say here that this book is dedicated to your wife and your son, who have for too long lived without a husband or father while I have pursued the white whale that is EMP. What motivated you to pay attention to EMP? Was it just because of what you found out over the years? Is that what happened, or was it something that has been with you for a while?
Oh, it's been with me a long time. EMP hasn't been the main thing I do. It isn't really the main thing almost anybody does. It had always been off to the sides. As people knew from reading my bio earlier, I worked on nuclear weapons strategy, weapons of mass destruction, the whole gamut of national security issues. But this has moved to become the focus of my professional career. Well, the reason I went into this was not to make money, but to try to make a difference with my life. And when I thought about, well, what are the areas that are most important? What is the threat that is greatest, the least understood, the one most likely to bring civilization to its knees. And it's this one. When I think of a whole gamut of the threats, and I've studied them all, I'm an expert in all of them where weapons of mass destruction is concerned, it's this one that is most worrisome to me. People know about biological warfare. We know about nuclear cities. We know about nuclear exchanges. We're doing a lot in all of those other areas. We know about cyber warfare. We have, in fact, got offices of cybersecurity in the White House all the way down to the county level. But EMP is still almost unknown. There are people that have still never heard of it. Even in the policymaking community, I still find people on the committees that are in charge of this that don't understand it and don't understand why it's important and have to be educated. And it's why I dedicated myself to it. I wish there was some big, well-funded bureaucracy trying to take care of it, but there isn't. There's really only my task force, which operates with no money. As a matter of fact, I could have added to that tribute to my wife and kid something new, an apology to them that I have to sell my farm. I'm actually putting my farm on the market, selling the family farm, and they're not happy about it, but they're following the old man, and there have been times when we've been able to take care of things, but when it comes to choosing between one's own personal interests and that of society and that of my fellow Americans, that's the real test. What kind of personal sacrifice are you willing to make? I guess I could avoid that by abandoning this cause and doing something else, but then there would be only a few voices left. I'm the leader of this task force. My family has loyally followed me and put up with all kinds of things, and they're still putting up with things. Things are getting, at least where the prize are concerned, life is getting worse, not better. And the least I can do is give them the tribute of that book. Someday, Ruth Pry and Frank Pry, my wife and son, they're the real heroes. I am sort of a Captain Ahab of BMP. I'm now obsessed with it.
Right.
But they're the ones that have to follow me into a life of poverty at a townhouse someplace as opposed to living out on a beautiful farm.
Well, here's the irony. The irony of the whole thing is I hope you're wrong. I hope we don't get a Carrington event in our life.
So do I.
And,
oh, so do I.
And of course, the other side of it is I hope you're right because I'd love to see people who are bright being proved right by all the others who, it's not going to happen. But of course, we don't want to see that happen. But I'll never forget during our first interview when you told me about your old man and your mom. You mentioned that you grew up in New York State, I believe it was, and your mom would cultivate a third of an acre, and she would cultivate every square inch of that land, and your dad would take you out and teach you how to hunt to take care of yourself, and I'll never forget the groundhogs you referred to them as, or he referred to them, and now, of course, you refer to them as Hoover hogs, right?
That's right. Everybody did back in the Great Depression. And there were Hoovervilles, people who were thrown out of their homes and they had to live in cardboard boxes and things like that. In tribute to Herbert Hoover, the president who was probably unfairly blamed for the Great Depression. He was unfairly blamed for the Great Depression. World War I and the Dust Bowl had a lot to do with bringing on the Great Depression. But, you know, that generation, that great generation that lived through the Great Depression and World War II, they learned. It wasn't just that they learned, but they were descended from other great generations, all of whom had these fundamental American values that are fast vanishing from our society. The values of self-efficiency and a pride in that. They didn't want to be dependent on government. They didn't want a handout. They didn't want to be taken care of. They didn't have the attitude that, well, it's the job of the Department of Defense to take care of me. No, they had seen society fail, both at the economic front. They had seen society fail when it came to international threats with Pearl Harbor. And they didn't defer to the experts and technocrats in Washington the way a lot of people want to today. They trusted themselves, and they realized that they were the first line of defense for their own family. And so those pioneer virtues of self-efficiency, knowing how to turn a Hoover hog into a meal for your family, knowing how to grow your own garden. Even in the city, my Uncle Joe, he owned a bar. He didn't have anything like an acre. He had, I think it looked like it was maybe 100 square feet, maybe 150 square feet, a 15-foot by 10-foot plot
right
off the back of his bar. And that was planted with vegetables. Everybody had who lived through the Great Depression because they'd been hungry before. And I think that it's not just a survivalist thing. This is sort of derided as survivalism now. But I think there's something fundamental to the American character that does set us apart from other peoples. And it's a psychology that's appropriate for a people that would rule themselves as a republic, not as a nation ruled by an imperial presidency.
Right.
That we are able to stand on our own feet and we are able to take care of ourselves and we can look at the government and spit in their eye and say, get the hell off my land. I'm taking care of my family. It gives you a pride and a sense of self-sufficiency that I think is necessary. When people become system dependent, the attitude changes and the virtues that made us a republic in the first place, a free people in the first place. How can you be free and be dependent? It's a contradiction.
Right.
Part of the theme of that white paper, that's in there too, that all the solution for this is not in Congress, it's not in the White House. The individual people can do a lot to be prepared themselves, and they should, just by doing what the great generation did. Start thinking about, what am I going to do if suddenly there's no food available? Have a food supply. Have an ability to have water. Know how to purify water. Have a medical kit in your home. You don't have to become an all-out survivalist, but if you learn some of the basics.
Can't hurt, right?
Yeah, prepared even a little bit can make a difference literally between life and death for you and your loved ones. It's not a Democrat or Republican thing. In the great generation, everybody was prepared. Everybody had gardens. Everybody knew how to hunt and fish. Everybody knew some basics about medical. Everybody had a grandmother who knew better than the doctor oftentimes how to deal with a sick child. Where is that America? We really need to bring it back, and we especially need to bring it back in the face of both a new terrifying age of weapons of mass destruction, where a crazy state like Iran, with a single nuclear weapon, can send us back into the 19th century again, where Mother Nature just might do it. Discovering this Carrington event and the possibility of a great geomagnetic storm, that's a lot like not being aware of a tidal wave if you were a Pacific Islander, and suddenly a tidal wave appears. Except at least we can do something about it, and we can do something deeply.
Right.
I would like to add that there is a scientific consensus on the EMP threat. There's nobody out there arguing in any government or respectable scientific study. Now, industry has actually put out a study that would deny that a geomagnetic storm would be catastrophic. So there is a point of view, there is an argument there, but it's a junk science argument that isn't supported by real, credible scientists.
Right.
Among the scientific community, there's a consensus that great geomagnetic storm is inevitable, that something like that's going to happen. Let's hope it doesn't happen in our lifetimes, at least. Or if it does, let's hope that we've taken the steps necessary to be prepared against it. And I'm with you, if we don't get prepared, well, let's hope we're all wrong and the industry is right, and that it is safe to travel by hydrogen zeppelin. That's what we're in now. We're traveling in a hydrogen zeppelin, my friend, and let's hope that the zeppelin industry is right.
How are those Hoover hogs, by the way?
They're really good if you know how to prepare them right.
Like
a stew? A stew is best. They're a red meat, and they taste a lot like duck steak or hamburger, and they can make a great chili. They can make a great stew. The younger ones are better than the older ones, tend to get tough.
Well, people better get familiar with these Hoover hogs. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, and I said it before, a great American and a great man. I want to thank you for all the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to speaking to you soon.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for having me on your show. You, too, are a great American. You're part of the solution just by allowing me to give voice to this much-neglected threat that is still not widely understood but needs to be. Thank you, sir.